right, so I've been sitting with this idea all week. This feeling that so many people carry around like a stone in their chest. The quiet conviction that they are simply not enough.
And what strikes me is how invisible it is. It doesn't announce itself. It just shapes every decision, every comparison, every moment someone holds back from something they actually want.
Right. And the key idea I want to establish early is that this isn't a measurement, it's a judgment. There's no scale somewhere that objectively reads insufficient. It's an interpretation a person applies to themselves.
That distinction matters enormously. Self-esteem, how someone evaluates their own worth, is entirely separate from self-efficacy, which is about whether they believe they can do a specific thing. Someone can be highly capable and still feel fundamentally worthless. The two don't automatically travel together.
So where does the judgment come from? Because it has to originate somewhere.
A lot of it comes from comparison. Social comparison is a normal psychological process. People naturally evaluate themselves against others. But the problem is asymmetry. Think of someone scrolling through a feed. They see another person's highlight reel, achievements, appearances, milestones. They almost never see that person's private doubts, failures, or uncertainty.
So the comparison is structurally rigged from the start.
Exactly. And research has found that frequent exposure to those upward comparisons, where someone else always appears to have the advantage, is associated with lower self-esteem over time. It's not just a feeling. It has measurable effects on how people evaluate themselves.
Now there's a concept from psycho-visceral surrealism that I think speaks directly to this. The idea that the artist Erich Screen articulated, I am the observer to my own unawareness. What does that phrase open up for someone wrestling with this spell of not enoughness?
It reframes the entire relationship. Most people who feel inadequate are not observing the feeling. They are inside it, fused with it. They've accepted the automatic thought as a fact. In cognitive behavioral terms, a thought like I am not enough is a hypothesis, not an established truth. But it rarely gets treated that way.
So not X, not I am not enough as a verdict, but Y. I am having the thought that I am not enough. That's a completely different position.
And that gap, between being the thought and observing the thought, is where everything changes. Mindfulness-based approaches describe exactly this, observing thoughts and feelings as experiences that arise, rather than automatically treating them as commands or facts.
There's also a shadow dimension here, the parts of ourselves we can't see or won't look at. Erich Screen said something that I think is one of the most precise articulations of this. My artwork reflects who I am and who I am not, who I know and who I do not know.
That's the shadow made visible. The who I am not and who I do not know. Those aren't absences. They're presences that haven't been acknowledged yet. And the not enough spell often lives exactly there, in the unexamined territory.
Mm-hmm. And the traditional response to that shadow is to fight it, slay the inner monster, overcome the weakness. But that's not what illumination means here, is it?
No. And this is a critical distinction. Illuminating the shadow isn't about destroying it. It's about seeing it clearly enough that it loses its grip. Shame, for instance, involves a global negative evaluation of the self. Guilt is narrower. It concerns a specific action. When someone can't distinguish between I did something wrong and I am wrong, the shadow stays invisible and the spell holds.
For example, someone makes a mistake at work. Overgeneralization turns that single event into a verdict. This proves I'm not capable, I never was. All or nothing thinking makes it binary, either completely successful or completely deficient. There's no middle ground allowed.
And that's where the spell calcifies. The mind takes one data point and writes a biography from it. The antidote isn't self-congratulation, it's self-compassion. Responding to personal suffering with kindness rather than contempt, while also recognizing that difficulty is part of common human experience. Research on self-compassion interventions has found significant reductions in self-criticism compared to control conditions.
And self-compassion isn't the same as avoiding accountability. That's a fear people have about it.
Right. It can coexist with acknowledging mistakes and making real changes. The takeaway for anyone sitting with this is that personal worth doesn't need to be continuously established by performance, approval, or comparison. That's not a soft idea. It's a more precise and accurate position than the one the spell offers.
What I keep returning to is that question Erich Screen's work keeps posing. How much of ourselves remains invisible to us until something gives it a form? The shadow isn't the enemy. It's the part of us that hasn't been seen yet.
And that's exactly where this course is heading. We've named the spell. We've located where it lives, in comparison, in automatic thought, in the unexamined shadow. The question that lingers now is, what does it actually take to look directly at it? That door is open. We'll walk through it next time.
And that's the thing about the imposter phenomenon too. It fits right into this. The belief that other people are overestimating your abilities. You're performing adequacy, while privately convinced the whole thing is about to collapse.
And research on that phenomenon has actually found real conceptual messiness in how it's been studied. Inconsistent definitions, ambiguous boundaries. Which is interesting, because the experience itself feels so certain, so absolute. But the framework we use to describe it is still being worked out.
So the person living it feels total certainty. And the science studying it is still sorting through what it even is.
That gap is worth sitting with, because it suggests the spell has more cultural construction in it than we admit. It's not a clean diagnosis. It's a pattern of thought, and patterns can be examined.
Now, here's where I want to push on something. Because the standard advice is usually, be kinder to yourself. Practice self-compassion. And people hear that and think it means letting themselves off the hook.
Right. And that's a fear that actually shows up in the research. Fears of self-compassion, receiving it, giving it, even extending it to yourself, have been associated with psychological difficulties, shame, self-criticism, depression, the very things self-compassion is supposed to address.
So the cure triggers the same resistance as the wound.
Exactly. And what the evidence actually shows is that self-compassion doesn't mean avoiding accountability. It can coexist with acknowledging a mistake and making a real change. A meta-analysis of self-compassion interventions, 19 studies, over 1,300 participants, found significant reductions in self-criticism compared to control conditions. That's not soft, that's measurable.
Mm-hmm. So the takeaway for someone sitting with this isn't forgive yourself and move on. It's more precise than that.
Much more precise. Personal worth doesn't need to be continuously established through performance, approval, or comparison. That's the reframe. Not I am enough as a mantra, but my worth isn't a variable that needs to be proven in every room I walk into.
Think of it this way. Someone walks into a meeting convinced they're about to be exposed. Every question feels like a test. Every pause feels like suspicion. They're not reading the room. They're reading their own shadow onto the room.
And that's the psycho-visceral dimension of this. The shadow isn't out there. It's the unexamined interior being projected outward. Eirik Skrien's philosophy, I am the observer to my own unawareness. That's not a passive stance. It's an active discipline. You step back far enough to see the projection happening.
And the artwork becomes the mirror for that. My artwork reflects who I am and who I am not, who I know and who I do not know. That's not just a statement about painting. That's a map of the interior.
The who I do not know is the operative phrase, because the not enough spell lives in that territory. It's not a verdict handed down from outside. It's a shape that formed in the dark, in the part of the self that hasn't been looked at directly yet.
And illuminating it, actually looking, that's different from fighting it. You're not trying to eliminate the shadow, you're trying to see what's casting it.
Which is why a practical approach matters here. Identify the triggering event. Write down the automatic interpretation. Distinguish what's evidence from what's assumption. Then formulate a more balanced alternative. That sequence doesn't erase the feeling, but it interrupts the spell long enough to examine it.
For example, someone gets passed over for a project. The automatic thought is, this confirms I was never qualified. But when they actually write it down and look at it, what's the evidence? What's the assumption layered on top?
And often, the assumption is doing most of the work. The event was real. The biography written from it. That's the overgeneralization. One data point turned into a verdict about the whole self. All or nothing thinking makes it binary. Either completely successful or completely deficient. No middle ground.
So the spell doesn't need a dramatic origin. It just needs one moment that gets interpreted the wrong way, and then repeated.
And that's what makes it so durable. It doesn't announce itself. It just quietly shapes what someone reaches for, what they hold back from, what they decide they're allowed to want. The shadow doesn't need to be loud to be powerful.
We've named the spell. We've traced where it lives, in comparison, in automatic thought, in the unexamined interior. And we've pointed toward what illumination actually requires. Not a battle, an observation.
The question that stays open, and it's the one this whole course is built around, is what it actually costs to look directly at the part of yourself you've been avoiding. That door is open, and next time, we walk through it together.
And what I find striking, the spell doesn't need a dramatic origin story. One moment, interpreted the wrong way, repeated quietly until it becomes the operating assumption.
That's the key idea. It doesn't announce itself. It just shapes what someone reaches for, what they hold back from, what they decide they're allowed to want.
So for someone sitting with this, the takeaway isn't say a mantra and move on. It's something more precise than that.
Much more precise. Personal worth isn't a variable that needs to be proven in every room someone walks into. That reframe matters. Not as a comfort, as an accurate correction to what the spell is actually claiming.
And that's where IRAC Screen's philosophy lands differently than standard self-help. I am the observer to my own unawareness. That's not passive, that's a discipline.
Exactly. And the artwork becomes the mirror for it. My artwork reflects who I am and who I am not. Who I know and who I do not know. The who I do not know, that's where the spell lives.
We've named the spell. We've traced where it lives. The question that stays open, what does it actually cost to look directly at the part of yourself you've been avoiding?
That door is open. Next time, we walk through it together.